You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Thursday, December 2nd, 2021. Way Down in the Hole, Part 2. Capturing CO2 for a Host of Industrial Uses. Published by Jason Lindquist. Carbon dioxide is not the most potent of the greenhouse gases, but it is by far the most prevalent, which makes it a primary focus of efforts to protect the planet. And while a lot of attention is being paid to ways to reduce CO2 emissions and to capture those that are produced, it's important to remember one key fact: there's strong demand for CO2 for a variety of commercial uses, from enhanced oil recovery and fertilizers to industrial processes and beverage production. In other words, CO2 has real value to certain parts of the global economy, and capturing CO2 for sale to these customers must be factored into the decarbonization equation. In today's RBN blog, we take a closer look at the industrial CO2 value chain. The push to ratchet down global greenhouse gases, or GHGs, has come to shove, and anyone who works in the energy industry or invests in it now needs to be familiar with CO2, its market dynamics, and the relationship between it and hydrocarbon markets. That new reality prompted us to take a deep dive into CO2, and in part one of this series, we focused on the midstream and downstream components that have been instrumental in the development of the US CO2 market. We discussed how CO2 is typically transported as a supercritical fluid and looked at the US pipeline networks that exist to help move it from place to place. There are more than 5,000 miles of operational CO2 pipe in the US, owned by 29 companies, with the leaders being Kinder Morgan, Denbury Incorporated, and Occidental Petroleum. We also looked at two major downstream dispositions of CO2 that have garnered the most attention from those focused on decarbonization. The first is carbon capture and sequestration, or CCS. Sequestration is the permanent storage of CO2 in the ground, way down in subsurface geologic formations, with the aim of keeping that profuse GHG permanently out of the atmosphere. There are a couple of close relatives of CCS that are worth knowing about too. One is carbon capture, use, and sequestration, or CCUS, which involves simultaneously using and sequestering CO2, exactly what happens with enhanced oil recovery, or EOR, which we'll touch on shortly. And then there's the oft-overlooked carbon capture and use, or utilization, also known as CCU, under which CO2 captured from industrial processes is used to make or process something, which we'll discuss as well. As we said in Knocked Out North America, the geographic focus of our blog series accounts for about one-third of global CO2 demand, and the largest users of CO2 by far are the energy industry, mostly for EOR, which we discussed in Part 5 of our The Air That I Breathe blog series, and the fertilizer industry, for the production of urea, the primary source of the nitrogen in fertilizer. More about that in a bit. In today's blog, we're going to examine the CO2 value chain. We'll start with the three sources of CO2, take a quick look at EOR and urea production, and then look at some of the other end uses for CO2, what we'll call the merchant market, and how they might be impacted if more CO2 ends up in the ground via CCS or CCUS. The CO2 value chain starts in one of three places: CO2 derived from naturally occurring underground sources, CO2 that is obtained through direct air capture, or DAC, and CO2 that is recovered from industrial processes, also known as anthropogenic CO2, or ACO2. CO2 sourced from natural wells is most commonly used in EOR. See The Air That I Breathe, Part 2, but some is also sold to the merchant market. Reservoirs include the McElmo Dome in southwestern Colorado, Bravo Dome in northeastern New Mexico, and Jackson Dome in Mississippi. At these reservoir sites, CO2 is tapped on purpose to bring huge volumes to the surface. Oil and gas companies that utilize EOR pay for that CO2 to be produced, then pay for it to be piped to where it is used. See The Air That I Breathe, Part 3, for a map of those systems. DAC, or direct air capture, is a high-minded concept but is generally considered a relatively inefficient way to recover CO2. The economics of carbon capture schemes hinge on the concentration of CO2 that needs to be processed to gather meaningful quantities of CO2. These systems aim to pull CO2 directly from the atmosphere, and even the most polluted air will have a much lower concentration than industrial processes. That hasn't stopped development of DAC, though. The recently enacted infrastructure bill includes $3.5 billion aimed at building four regional DAC hubs that will each have the capacity to capture at least 1 million metric tons, or MT, of CO2 per year. In a subsequent blog in this series, we'll be looking at the logic and economics of this DAC hub development policy. CO2 is the anthropogenic, or man-made, CO2 that's generated by processing or burning fossil fuels and by other industrial processes, such as in the production of ethanol, hydrogen petrochemicals, and refined products. If you capture a facility's emissions and separate out that CO2, it can then be utilized for other applications. Some CO2 generators are situated next to affiliated facilities that can utilize some or all of the captured CO2. Otherwise, the excess CO2 can be compressed into a supercritical fluid and either piped, railed, or trucked to where it's needed. The CO2 that serves the merchant market is generally sourced from four main categories, natural sources being one of them. Nearly one-third of the CO2 bound for merchant market end users is sourced from ethanol production, as an ethanol plant that produces 50 million gallons a year can also produce about 150,000 mt of CO2 per year. During ethanol production, CO2 is captured during the fermentation stage. About a fifth of CO2 for the merchant market comes from hydrogen production and refining. Most hydrogen is made by running natural gas through a steam methane reformer, or SMR, and most SMR units end up emitting CO2 produced during the process into the atmosphere, but the CO2 can be captured as well. Oil refineries, another carbon-intensive area, are also a significant source of CO2. Another fifth or so of the CO2 used by the merchant market comes from ammonia production. Ammonia is one of the most commonly produced chemicals in the world and an important part of most fertilizers and several other products, but making ammonia is an energy-intensive process responsible for about 1% of global CO2 emissions. A lot of that CO2 is destined for urea production facilities nearby. The rest is typically sold to the merchant market. Before we go on, we should take a moment to note that the generation and consumption of CO2 in urea production is, in a way, a separate world of its own, but its magnitude makes it critical in understanding supply and demand dynamics in the merchant CO2 market. More than 90% of global urea production is for use as a nitrogen release fertilizer. The way it's produced basically goes like this: to start, the steam methane reforming, or SMR, process. See help. Part 2 for details on how it works. React steam, or H2O, methane, aka natural gas, or CH4, to produce hydrogen, or H2, and carbon monoxide, or CO. From there, additional hydrogen can be yielded through a process called the water gas shift, where the CO is reacted again with steam. That leaves CO2 and H2. The CO2 is removed, and the H2 is combined with N2, or nitrogen, to form ammonia, or NH3. Then, the ammonia along with the CO2 generated by the energy-intensive Haber-Bosch process used to create that ammonia as well as the previously removed CO2 are typically used at a plant next door to form ammonium carbamate, which is dehydrated to form urea. Put simply, the CO2 required for urea production is, in essence, provided by adjacent ammonia plants. A portion of the CO2 generated in ammonia production is accessed to the urea plant's needs and is sold to others. CO2 that goes into the merchant market is typically liquefied and delivered to end users by truck or rail. Chief among the major end users in the merchant market for CO2 is the food industry, which uses nearly half of the liquid CO2, mostly for chilling or freezing food. Another 14% gets used in the beverage industry for carbonating our sodas. Together, that's more than 60% of liquid CO2 sourced by the merchant market. Another 14% goes into industrial processes such as welding. About 13% of it is used to produce dry ice, with another 8% used by municipalities for water and waste treatment, and the last 4% going to fire extinguishers and other uses. Given the big push to capture and sequester CO2, and thereby keep it out of the atmosphere, merchant market CO2 end users increasingly find themselves in competition for CO2 supply with businesses that are focused on CCS and CCUS, including new CO2 sink markets being developed to keep at least some CO2 out of the atmosphere. That competition has been growing increasingly fierce lately due to government incentives to capture and sequester CO2, such as 45Q tax credits or, when used for fuel production, low carbon fuel standard, or LCFS, markets. Those opportunities are spurring innovative ways to dispose of CO2, and many of the proposed methods have met with their own skepticism as to the permanence of their sequestration. Among the many new CO2 sinks being discussed and developed, a few frequently mentioned are the following. Number 1. Renewable diesel. CO2 can be used in green fuel production, such as in the manufacture of renewable diesel in some processes, see Californication and Come Clean, Part 5, and sold into California's LCFS market, as described in Come Clean, Part 2 and our latest drill down report. The potential synergy with CO2 and hydrogen means that those products can find markets in areas where renewable diesel production is centralized, and that's particularly notable when we begin to look at the areas where renewable diesel facilities are being developed. Number 2. Concrete. CO2 curing, or the introduction of CO2 during the curing stage of concrete, is seen as a way to utilize emissions captured from industrial processes. Cement is one of the main ingredients, along with water, sand, and gravel, in concrete, which accounts for about 5% of global GHG emissions. Number 3. Building materials. Construction aggregates, small particulates used in building materials, can be produced by reacting CO2 with waste materials, such as iron slag and coal fly ash, which would otherwise be stockpiled or stored in a landfill. Producing building materials like bricks from waste and CO2 can be competitive as it offsets the cost associated with conventional waste disposal. Number 4. Plastics. CO2 can be used as an alternative to fossil fuels in the production of chemicals, including plastics and synthetic rubber. As with CO2-derived fuels, converting CO2 to methanol and methane is the most technologically mature pathway. The methanol can be subsequently converted into other carbon-containing high-value chemical intermediates used to manufacture plastics and aromatics, which are used in a range of sectors including health and hygiene, food production, and processing. As important as CCS and CCUS may be, they, and 45Q tax credits, pose a real challenge to food processors, beverage makers, and other merchant market consumers of CO2. A key question is, how much will these established markets have to pay for CO2 when federal tax credits are offering to pay $35 per ton in the case of CCUS or $50 per ton in the case of CCS for disposal of CO2? And what about if those tax credits get expanded? In the next installment in this series, we'll look at the 45Q tax credit and the role it's playing in the development of several sequestration projects. Way Down in the Hole was written by Tom Waits and appears as the second song on side 2 of Waits' 10th studio album, Frank's Wild Years. The song was used as the theme song for the HBO crime drama series, The Wire. The series ran for 5 seasons from 2000 to 2008. In addition to Waits' version, a different recording of Way Down in the Hole was used for each season, including versions by the Blind Boys of Alabama, the Neville Brothers, Dumajay, and Steve Earle. Personnel on the Waits record were Tom Waits on vocals and pump organ, Mark Rebo on guitar, Greg Cohen on bass, Michael Blair on drums and percussion, Ralph Carney on sax, and Angela Brown, Leslie Holland, and Lynn Jordan on backing vocals. Frank's Wild Years was recorded during 1987 at Universal Recording in Chicago and the Sound Factory in Sunset Sound in Hollywood. The album contains songs written for a play of the same name. Several songs from the album have appeared in television shows, movies, and stage productions. Produced by Waits, the album was released in August 1987 and went to number 115 on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart. Tom Waits is an American songwriter, singer, musician, and actor. He began his professional career performing on the San Diego folk circuit as a teen in the late 1960s. He moved to Los Angeles in 1972, where he worked as a songwriter before securing his first record deal with Asylum Records. He has released 17 studio albums, 3 live albums, 7 compilation albums, 2 soundtrack albums, and 24 singles. His songs have been covered by many artists from different genres. Waits has appeared in over 24 motion pictures. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2011. His last tour was in 2008 and his last LP, Bad As Me, was released the same year. He will have a featured role in the upcoming movie, Licorice Pizza, scheduled for a holiday release in a few weeks.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.